It looks like we've got an election coming up pretty soon, and it is as good a time as any to talk about the state of American democracy, and perhaps the state of democracy in general. And I am joined again by YouTube's favorite philosopher, Dr. Greg Sadler, who is here to chat with me about some things going on as we lead into the election and the state of American democracy. Now, Greg, you've been on a podcast with me before, but just remind the audience who you are, just in case they didn't listen to the previous episode where you joined me.
Well, I'm a college professor who has over time turned into a, you could say, philosopher in private practice. I do a lot of consulting and tutorials and other types of work. I am teaching this semester, though, full time for a number of different institutions, but I'm not sure if that's going to be the case in the future. So, and I also produce YouTube videos. I think probably most of your viewers and listeners know me through those.
Yes, definitely. I'm a big fan of your channel. You get pretty deep into things. And what I like about Greg's work is it goes all the way back to Plato and Aristotle, but then he can turn around and talk to you about John Paul Sartre and other existentialists. And of course, you know, I believe that you specialize in Stoicism as one of your big interests. So definitely check out Greg Sadler's YouTube channel. And what I really like about Greg's work is he puts philosophy into practice. Like, there's always a practical element when he is talking about something. And for me, Greg, a struggle that I have right now is the election is about a week away. And I've always been somebody who's been political. I was raised in a family that was always talking politics. I had a lot of fun with it. Of course, the 2016 election, especially during the primaries, it was so much fun. Everybody was following the debates and all of this stuff. And then it just seemed to get nasty, for lack of a better word. And I've realized that the political process really hasn't been fun for me. It hasn't been good for just maintaining personal friendships. I feel like that my participation in American democracy, as toxic as it's gotten, I really wonder if it wouldn't be a better for my well-being, better for my personal well-being, not just as an American, but as a human being, if I may be tuned out and perhaps considered not voting for this election cycle. I don't know if things are going to get worse or better, but I feel like it's just gotten to a point with all of the pandering. And it seems to me like perhaps some of the worst warnings that we got from the ancient Greek philosophers about democracy are coming to light right now. And so that's really where I stand, Greg, that I'm really, as somebody who has always voted in the past, I'm really thinking about not voting. What do you think? And what do your philosophers have to say to that?
Well, there's a lot of stuff packed into that question. And, you know, you're talking about not voting, but you're also talking about something that's broader than that, which is backing off from and disengaging from political and, you know, that means social and cultural life to some degree as well here in the States, because everything is so tightly bound up. And that also probably means, I don't know, adopting some sort of different stance towards social media. You might have to go through and prune out some of your accounts that you're following, or mute them. So that'd be kind of hard to do, quite frankly, as connected as we tend to be these days. So there's the not voting part, and we can certainly talk about that. I've got some thoughts on that, and I was able to tap some other people's brains on that in the past, during previous elections, where they were considering casting a principled non-vote. And I was always suspicious of that. So we could talk about that. And then the ancient Greeks would have stuff to say, not just about democracy, but about something they called stasis, which means something like social breakdown, or it's translated as faction. And I think that we are in that situation more and more these days. Really, really dangerous and really problematic. Both of us are old enough to remember a time when politics, while not entirely civil, at least had more common ground. And I've been thinking about this. You know, you've got your high school students, I've got my college students. None of them have actually grown up in an environment where the level of conflict that we have wasn't the norm. So we have an entire generation of people who that's the picture of politics for them. And that doesn't bode well, I think, for us.
Yeah, I think that I remember being in high school and you would have possibly the token conservative or the token leftist in a friendship group. You know, my friends that I was on the debate team with, we had a full range of political perspectives and we really enjoyed going back and forth and talking about those things and arguing and debating. And then it was just all in good fun after that. Nobody felt threatened by somebody else's perspective. That's one thing I've heard from a lot of people where they say that I can't be friends with these people who believe like this because they are a threat to me. They're a threat to this country. And so and we're talking about that, or a lot of people in this country are talking about that in terms of these are people who are Americans just like them and likely share a lot of their core values, but that's not really coming out in the current discourse. And I've actually, you mentioned social media. Twitter has got a lot of great tools now. I didn't realize until about a month ago, not only can you mute accounts, but you can also mute words. So recently, if somebody decides, I want to mute Kavanaugh, and during all of that stuff, and they can say that I don't want to be engaged in this. But then, of course, I think what you're talking about as well, you mentioned that if I'm thinking about not voting or trying to disengage politically, that there is a certain amount of disengagement from society, and we are by nature social beings. So that sounds... it's definitely not just an isolated, I'm just not going to participate in the political community type thing from what you're saying.
Yeah, and in a way it's been forced on us because there are so many people that are, so for one reason or another, so invested, so charged up about politics that if you want to disengage, you do have to leave a lot of things behind. And some of it's unpredictable. I mean, you can't tell whether you're going to go to dinner with somebody and they're going to go into some political screed from the right or the left, or even, you know, some long harangue about how we should all be able to get along. So there's that. And, you know, the polarization has gotten so bad that people who run dating apps have and platforms have found that there's a lot of requests. Don't, you know, pair me up with any Democrats. Don't pair me up with any Republicans. That's a really bad sign. And it starts to infect professional relationships, and contacts, you know. So there's all of that stuff, and we could call that sort of the spillover from the directly political into the cultural and the social. And then there's the political itself. And we'll talk about the non-voting idea in just a second, but I wanted to come back to, just how things got so polarized. And I think there's, you know, at the core, there's really a couple different things that often get blurred together that are going on. One is that the political becomes a proxy for all sorts of other values, meaning that in the past, I mean, we know that, for example, religious commitment and attendance has been going down decade to decade to decade. And there's lots of people who still, you know, are invested in traditional religion, but the numbers are somewhat shrinking. And even, you know, many of those who are participating, it's very unclear from a religious studies perspective just how well, you know, they understand what they're doing and how committed they are to it. And sometimes the religious actually becomes a proxy for the political too. You see this with a lot of the mainline Protestant churches. You see this with a lot of conservative Catholics, where really it's the Democrat or Republican Party that's sort of preaching the sermon, not the person at the pulpit, or organizing the activities or things like that. So the political has become much, much more important. Whereas when we were younger, it was very important, but it wasn't the only driving thing. And then you mentioned that people see each other as a threat. Well, I think a lot of people view politics as a zero-sum game. So if you succeed and you're on the other side, then your success is somehow my loss, or the loss of those who identify with. And there's a lot of ratcheting up of the rhetoric, too. I suppose that could be a third thing. You know, a lot of the legislation that we see coming forward, or the Supreme Court cases or the executive orders, they do affect people's lives, and some of them much more than others. But it's rarely so direct as the slogans make us think. And there's lots of people who want to think through slogans, you know, because they're, especially in this social media rich environment, you know, a slogan is tailor made for a tweet. And then you can, you know, tie it in with a picture and you got a meme, right? So I think you put all of these things together and a few other factors and we get this, like you called it, it's rather toxic. And it's toxic not just in terms of affecting our relations between each other or affecting our regime as a totality, the American regime that we live in and which is supposed to be protecting us, say, from outside threats. But it's also poisoning people from within. So I think there's a lot of people who are politically engaged who are much less happy than they would be if they were less politically engaged or if they're politically engaged in a different way. And here's where I think philosophy actually could help us, but not in a, you know, snap your fingers, here's the solution direct way. But, you know, if you think about virtue ethics and the emphasis on understanding yourself and the bases on which you're making decisions, which include decisions about what you're saying or what to post, and then, you know, changing those over time, moving them towards the virtues, which include wisdom and justice. Not just wisdom and justice as we'd like to portray ourselves as having them, which any political hack can do, but the actual virtues that provide us with sort of light posts, you know, we can navigate by them. You know, if you adopt that sort of perspective, it can make you less unhappy with the political situation that we've got, and I think it could sustain you while being engaged. It also would deflate some of these things. You know, you're not in a struggle to the death with the opponents. You're going to doing the mundane business of casting a vote, you know, and you know what that's like, standing in line, filling out the card, putting it in there. It's rather anticlimactic, right? But yeah, so those are not particularly organized reflections, but those are the things I'd say about that. But we should talk about the non-voting thing, right? I think, you know, this started coming about, I remember, already in the 2000 election. Some people were saying, I can't in good conscience vote for either of these candidates. I can't vote for either of these parties. And they would say, well, I'm going to not vote, and that's going to be my way of casting a vote. And my answer to that has always been, well, how the hell is your non-vote different from the guy who just slept in and didn't bother to vote? Nobody can tell what your non-vote is for. And I've put this to people like Alistair McIntyre and Paul Griffiths, who both have argued in past elections that the thing to do is to not vote. And I don't think either of them had a sufficient reply on that grounds. They did say other things that would contribute to an answer, like, well, listen, you know, you really can't vote for either of these parties if you value, say, Catholic social justice teachings in the case of both of those two thinkers, and you look at where the Democrat Party is and the Republican Party. You can't align yourself with either one. And so if you write an op-ed piece explaining why you cast your non-vote, okay, that might have some impact, but a non-vote by itself, you or me just deciding not to walk into the polling station or maybe handing in a blank ballot, that's not going to accomplish anything.
And I guess for me, it's a little bit different because I definitely at this current time. Now, of course, when you say you align with a party, people will put all kinds of other things into that. But I think, you know, if I were to vote in this election, I would personally vote Republican. I don't really have a lot of qualms about that, but it is more, it's less in terms of, oh, well, I want to make an impact or something, or I can't vote for either of these parties, but more, what is this doing to me personally? Is this something that is enriching my life? And so it's something that I'm considering, and I haven't really made up my mind yet, but I'm considering because I think a lot of people, we've gotten to where we're told it's your civic duty, quote unquote, to vote.
Yeah.
That if you don't vote, then you're a bad person.
You're not, you don't get to complain about anything. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. When they say if you didn't vote, then you don't get to complain. And it's like when it comes down to it, when you analyze this logically, what does that really have to? So if somebody voted, then they can complain all they want. I think we're kind of tired of that. We've heard a great deal of complaining from people. But then again, does the non-voter, does that decision in a way say, you know what? I'm not going to complain. I'm going to put my head down. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to focus on my family. And my job and my friendships and things that, you know, some friendships being affected by politics. Yeah. And not necessarily intentionally, but when somebody else, like, you know, I've had situations where I didn't hold my friends' politics against them, but I could see that there was a wall up. Not using any kind of, no pun intended or anything like that,
yeah.
But a wall up because the person knows that my politics don't align with theirs. And when I approach them, there's a part of them that sees that's the enemy. And there's this dissonance where this person on a personal level is my friend, but on a political level is my enemy. And it puts tension into a friendship, possibly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's because of the importance that we assign, whether we realize it or not, whether we're doing this unconsciously or, you know, deliberately, to the political realm. And that's that sort of ratcheting up of importance. And it's usually because other things have become less important, you know. You think about why do people in times of economic difficulty become so politically engaged? Well, it could be because, you know, having a job actually takes your attention away from all of this other stuff. I mean, unless you're constantly posting at your job, which will get you in trouble, right? just think of our jobs. You know, if you're teaching and you're constantly, you know, holding up bumper stickers or something, you get in a lot of trouble. But you know, people have invested the political with their hopes and fears and dreams and passions. And so that's part of it. As far as the non-voting thing goes, though, you could be politically engaged and be posting constantly on Twitter and still not go to vote because you're too lazy to actually vote, right? And I think there's, you know, think about how many people sound off about stuff, and in midterms, what's the actual rate of the population going to vote? I mean, sometimes it's as low as like 17% in a national midterm election. So clearly there's a lot of people who are saying stuff and engaging with people who aren't actually voting. Now on the other hand, you know, I actually would be for something like mandatory voting across the board. You know, if we made it easier for people to vote and we had some sort of, you know, national system instead of the mess of a patchwork of state and local systems like we currently have. It was just a cluster, you know. I mean, you think about like our systems of education, or our people talk about our prison system. And I'm always pointing out to people, there is no system. For prisons, there are 50 departments of corrections. Some of them aren't even called that. They might be called the Bureau of Corrections. And then there's all these local jails. And each one does its own thing. And every once in a while, the federal government will get involved and engage in some oversight. But a lot of the time, it's, you know, what happens in one county doesn't translate into the next county. It's the same way for voting, you know. I mean, we're reading these interesting stories about, say, the voting machines in Texas not working right. I have no idea what voting machines they have in Texas, because we have totally different machines up here, you know. And I just have to sort of take it for granted that they're screwed up in the ways that they're talking about, because I don't know. You know, I haven't gone down there to verify anything. And if I wanted to, I mean, imagine the job of going around to like all the different counties and seeing just what they're doing as far as like voting practices. It'd be impossible, you know.
Well, and then in some states, it's illegal to record your vote or to post something. So if somebody so somebody in Texas, and I don't know which way, I saw the headline about the voting machines, but if someone goes in to vote for Ted Cruz and all of a sudden it says Beto, and if you're recording this,
took,
and
like
of course,
a snapshot with your phone or something.
Right. And so what are the odds somebody's going to video record this whole thing happening? And then if they post it in some states, they've actually, now I don't think people have been prosecuted for it, but it is actually illegal to record, you know, to have some sort of recording of your ballot or the voting booth or something like that. But yes, I think that we don't have, I mean, I've actually come, it's interesting. That's why I like having you on here, because in a lot of cases, we think about different solutions to these things. I personally think that too many people vote in this country. Now, just to be clear, it's not that I think that less people should vote in general, but I think that when we think about the amount of people who actually understand what's going on and they're actually, they know what they're doing, they're engaged, I think that in a lot of our elections, the number of people voting far exceeds the number of people who actually have actually investigated for themselves. Right. And I'm talking about people who consume print media. Like, I would really, like, I'd love for people, for everybody who consumes political print media to vote. But as far as just somebody who is, you know, has the cable news turned on or is scrolling through Facebook or Twitter, and that's how they've come to their conclusion about how they're going to vote, I'm a bit skeptical about that being the basis for a functioning government.
You know, John Stuart Mill had a proposal. He thought that what we Americans did was crazy, that we let everybody vote. And he talks about this in his remarks on representative government. And he brings up what's nowadays called epistocracy. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. And the idea is that either you restrict the franchise in a way by saying you have to meet certain minimal qualifications, or you weight the votes according to some sort of demonstration of intelligence or knowledge. And it sounds pretty good on its face, but you can never get people to actually agree about how precisely it would work. Because there have actually been books out recently about this, where people are proposing this. The trouble is, well, there's a couple troubles. One is you'd never get this past the Republican and Democrat, you know, machines, because they would see this as a major threat. But let's say you could. Let's say you could actually convince all of them, and somehow it would probably take a constitutional amendment, I imagine. Or some sort of super sweeping legislation that would be Supreme Court, you know, proof. And that would be pretty tough to pull off. But let's say you could do it, then you'd have a practical question. Okay, well, how do you decide this? And one proposal is you use something like a citizenship test, where you have to demonstrate a certain basic competence with democratic institutions in the United States, maybe a little bit of constitutional history, some stuff about basic ideas. But the trouble is, who then would write the test? You know? Because could you get enough consensus? And I don't think we could. I think in previous times we probably could get enough consensus, but things are so bitter and mean-spirited right now that whoever got to write the test would be under attack. So that one's probably a non-starter.
I think about the recent AP revisions that for the AP history courses, and there was, of course, a lot of political backlash in those cases.
Yeah, yeah.
But then they ended up addressing some of those things. But it is interesting that it really goes into all aspects of life. But yes, I'd run into that John Stuart Mill bit before, and yes, on its face, I like it in the sense that give everybody one vote. But if you graduate high school, for example, you get a high school diploma or even a GED. Okay, then now we give you another point. Go and take this citizenship test, the same thing that people take to become a citizen of the United States. You get another point. And so having some kind of point system where people who have actually invested something in the political system get more of a say. But see, I think also, and this is what really bothers me, and I'm coming from a right of center perspective, but when I look at some of the things, like I watched part of President Trump's rally in Texas for Ted Cruz, and he said, "Elect Beto, and he will replace freedom with socialism. All of your guns are going to be gone," and you know, going down this whole list, which informed citizens typically can see, okay, if the other party takes one house of Congress, or even what we've seen now, and that this has been an interesting thing when I've talked to friends of mine who are left of center, I've asked them, 2 years in, is it as bad as you thought it would be with Republicans controlling the presidency, the Senate, and the House? And most people who had these apocalyptic sort of visions when they saw the surprise results of the 2016 election, I don't think that those have really come to fruition. And I think that most of the informed portion of the electorate understands this. And I think that one of my issues is that the discourse has become so lowest common denominator, because it's really the appeals are to emotions rather than somebody's rational inclinations.
There's that. And then another feature, and this is something that somebody like Aristotle would see as a major problem. Elections are never over anymore. So it used to be in the past that, a candidate would win, maybe the Congress, would shift power in some way in a major presidential election, even in midterms, and then people would have to adjust and start moving on. There's so much rancor now that it doesn't matter who wins. And this really started, I would say, in a major way with the election of President Bush in 2000 over Gore. And because there was a contested election, and they were clearly at opposite ends from things. And then we had things ratcheted up because of 9/11 and the subsequent war. But the Democrats, they viewed him as an illegitimate president. And then we saw the exact same thing coming from the right for 8 years of the Obama administration. The right did not accept that the election had decided things. And I think now we're seeing that as well from the left. And I don't see any way back to that. It's not even civility. It's more like accepting procedure and then choosing to move on. So whoever, wins these midterms, they're always going to be under attack, and it's not going to resolve anything. Then we're going to have another election in 2020, and maybe Trump will, go, and some, who knows what Democrat is actually going to run against him. And maybe they'll be in, or maybe it's another 4 years of the Trump administration, but, the winning party will be, claiming they have a mandate, which they almost never do. And the losing party will be just going after the winning party and all of their causes for the entire time, trying to gin up more and more support. And this is really bad for the rest of us. I'm a registered independent, and I hate seeing what our country has come to in terms of both parties, the lobbying machines, the gerrymandering that's gone on that means that so many House seats are not really competitive races, the almost sheer impossibility of any third party getting any traction the way our election rules are set up and even how we carry out debates. I see this as a really bad sign. Aristotle would see this as, if you look at Politics Book 5, this is a country that is headed for, civil discord. We're losing a sense of the legitimacy of the political process and the people who hold office because it has become so partisan. And the trouble is, you could say, well, you need to appeal to the base. And that's true. The Republican Party and the Democrat Party, these are coalitions of base supporters. But neither of them is governing for when they have the chance for the common good, for the good of the totality of the nation. And I think many of them don't even care anymore about that. They're interested in serving their side and trying to suppress the other side. If this trend continues, we can look forward to social breakdown, and both parties will be responsible for it.
And by social breakdown, do you think a possible scission or even a civil war type scenario or anything like that? Like, what do you mean by a social breakdown?
I don't think that we would see the nation itself split along the lines of some sort of succession happening, like California breaking off or Texas breaking off or anything like that. I think that's a done deal. But I do think we'll see a lot more, violence between the two sides. And the kind of violence that doesn't care about how it impacts other people. When you have, over and over again, people clashing with each other. It interrupts traffic. It in, you know, it takes up time from people's lives. It winds up you know, producing more and more drags on the economy, because doing business in those areas costs more. And I think we're going to see a lot of conflict like that arising, because if you can't have a sense that it's, you know, we need to cooperate on really basic things, why should people, you know? And again, think about the younger people who are just seeing this as a norm. You've got a cause, push it out there. And if anybody resists you, well, they're bad people and they don't see things your way. And you know, we can go on and on and on and on. When that becomes, when that, you know, this is another thing that, that the ancient philosophers and also Alexis de Tocqueville saw. It's not just our ideas. It's the habits that we form. And habits include how we relate to each other. So if the new habit or the new norm becomes, you know, your political opponent puts something out, figure out how you can attack them immediately and, you know, incite violence against them if possible. And then pull back from saying, I never incited violence. That becomes a new, you know, MO. And, when things get to that point, we start to resemble countries in the third world that don't have a long history of democracy. We're sort of, this is, you know, me on a soapbox, we're sort of like a person who's lived off of a trust fund for a very long time. And instead of just living on the interest and maybe even contributing to it, they kept drawing down on the principal. That's what we've done with our democratic institutions and our history. We have used up a lot of our social capital that, if you look at like Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, written in, you know, the 1840s. Now, we were heading for a civil war at that time, but so clearly a failure of democracy in that case. But he could talk about certain things as being, you know, the new American way of doing things, you know, the role of what he called intermediate institutions, you know, all these clubs and organizations that Americans belong to in which they could exercise some leadership and not just be passive consumers or pawns of other people. And this, you know, helped them develop their character. Those sort of things have been gutted, you know, and we haven't seen the kind of consensus that we would actually need in order to deal with the challenges ahead of us. And there are massive challenges, you know, not just, let's say, the rise of China, but something that, that is a massive challenge for both us and China, the rise of the machines. You know, what are we going to do when AI and logistics and robotics puts about, you know, 30% of the population out of work permanently? That's looming in our lifetime. Do we have a political system that can actually respond to that? No, they both keep, you know, both parties keep saying we're going to create more jobs because that's, you know, a nice buzzword. And if we don't have the kind of cooperation that we need, if we can't exercise the prudence together through deliberation, we're screwed, you know, as a country and as a culture. And I hate to see that, you know, and I know you do as well, because we're, you know, we're both in some ways antiquarians. We're invested in an older understanding of what it means to be American. But that's not something we can take for granted.
I see. And that is now mentioning Aristotle's Politics. You know, what yeah. I'm thinking about as well. And I'm struggling with this a bit, because you've mentioned we have this constitution that was created a federal system, and yeah. it worked at the time. And I love our constitution. I think it's great. But at the same time, it was very much inspired by Aristotle's Politics, in the sense that Aristotle believed that the government had to be structured in a way that didn't allow one party to dominate the whole thing, that there would be, you know, he saw democracy without some sort of aristocratic check as something that would degenerate. And I wonder if we're seeing that, like we look at the 17th Amendment with the direct election of senators and some other things that we've seen, the popular election of the president, that when the presidency was initially designed to have some you know, for the Electoral College to put some distance between the presidency and the American people. And then we see now that the president is a faction leader, a party leader. And now we even have, you know, a situation where, and of course, I'm not defending, you know, President Trump's current rhetoric, which some people, you know, have a good point when they talk about this as unpresidential. But from what I've seen of President Obama's appearances in this election, where we're dealing with his immediate successor, and his appearances are very, you know, his rhetoric is very partisan, very critical of his immediate successor. And so we're seeing a breakdown in some of those traditions where, okay, not only in terms of the current president, but a former president, there are lines that previously weren't crossed. That
that one started getting crossed with Jimmy Carter, and then Bill Clinton's criticisms of George Bush in the early 2000s Bush regime, and that was something new, and people commented on it.
And I guess one thing that I could think about here is when you think about George W. Bush, I think he kind of pulled back and tried to bring back that old, so it's not like this is unprecedented, but George W. Bush decided, hey, I'm going to be low-key, I'm not going to be critical of my immediate successor, I'm not going to get out on the campaign trail, and so that could be seen as trying to pull back, but we've seen this already in the works with previous ex-presidents, so...
Yeah, I mean, I would say we do have an aristocracy, but it's an oligarchy rather, but it's a shifting one. And, you know, we use power and access as one measure for it. We use wealth as another. And, you know, rank or social prestige we use as well. And they do, you know, people who have a lot of wealth do in fact control a lot of what goes on in the country. And you can rise into it, but it takes a hell of a lot of work. And it's much more difficult now than it was, say, 50 years ago. The openings are not as easy to find. Aristotle, so, you know, when somebody was asking me about this just yesterday, one of my clients, and he was talking about, did Aristotle have a best regime? And I said, well, yes and no. I mean, he thought all of the Greek city-states of his time were badly run, and many of them were poorly set up. And he carried out, you know, with his students, a survey of about 140 of them. We only have one of them left, the Athenian Constitution. And there he's very critical of the developments that took place within that Constitution's history. I said, well, I mean, Aristotle does advocate something that the founding fathers looked to, in a way, as the mixed regime, right? You'd mix democracy and oligarchy. But he didn't say, you know, that's the best regime. He just said, well, this is, you know, most regimes are democracies or oligarchies of one sort, and both of them are bad regimes. You know, each one has a version that's a good regime. So a democracy, it's something that we call a politeia or constitutional government. The difference is in democracy, it's, you know, everyone gets to vote and they decide things, but they all just care about themselves or their party. Whereas in a politeia, you have some actual focus on the common good. And that requires that you do some things that might be seen as foolish from a strategic perspective or anti-democratic. Likewise, an oligarchy, you know, just having money doesn't make anybody smarter or better disposed towards the republic. An aristocracy would be the opposite, where people are actually ruling for the good of the totality, the whole. And Aristotle said, well, you can kind of blend these two together. And sometimes it's called that, the blended regime, where it's got some oligarchical elements to it and some democratic elements to it. But it's still going to be pretty screwed up. You know, it's still not going to be ideal. It's just not going to have all the excesses of those two. Later on in the politics, he said, there's really three groups that you need to take account of. One is the rich, because they do, in fact, contribute more. You know, if we talk about the rich as job creators, that's sometimes true. You know, sometimes it's actually false, that rhetoric, but sometimes they actually do make important contributions. And then there's the many who are free. And there is a legitimate value there to having a lot of different voices and getting different people's takes on things and having the people who are a little bit closer to the factory floor sometimes talking about how the factory should be run. But the third group that's absolutely important that gets overlooked, and there's almost no room for it in our political system, are the good. the best, the aristoi, the people who actually have and display virtue. If you're rich, you don't necessarily have to have any virtue. If you're among the many, that doesn't make you virtuous. You've got to identify the people who actually hold things together and, you know, do the work day in, day out, making things better and care about, you know, everybody involved and don't hold grudges and act justly, because those are the ones who are going to keep things from falling apart. If you only have the rich and the many, that's going to fall apart. That's not a stable dynamic. And that's unfortunately, I think, where we've gone in our politics, with the proviso that the Democrats don't represent the many either, because there's just as much of an oligarchy within the Democratic power structure. Yeah, I mean, take Obama, for example, right? Obama's incredibly rich. Can he really speak for the rest of us? He wasn't incredibly rich when he started out. You know, this is what happens when you go into politics. You know, you become part of the, however you want to put it, the 1%, the 9%. You become detached from the people who you represent. And that happens on both sides. So Aristotle would say that, unless we can turn it around and start shifting focus and priority in ways that don't take their cues from the two main parties and the ways that they're doing things, we're really in, you know, we're in decline. And there's nothing about America as an exceptional nation that says it can't come to an end, you know. Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I believe that it's Gibbon who said about the Romans, that part, okay, when we're thinking about why is it that the Romans declined, part of that, he said, was immoderate greatness, that any civilization that achieves such immoderate greatness for a time, there's going to be some sort of regression to the mean. And you'd look at the British Empire. That wasn't going to last forever. The Roman Empire and then the American Empire. And that is something that we kind of have to, and as a history guy, I know that I can't judge it right now just looking at the present, but yeah. I can look back and see that, okay, I mean, and of course, that's such a divisive phrase now, the idea of making America great again, but, you know, and what people mean by that, but we certainly can look back and see that in the mid to late 20th century that the United States was a global leader and people, you know, other countries look to us for leadership, and we provided it in a way that people aren't looking to us now, and we're not providing now and in recent years and decades. So as far as that goes, I think that there is, you know, how is it that Americans, and maybe this is symptomatic of, we realize there's something about the country that's not what it used to be. We're trying to deal with that. But it's just the general thing here. And I think when I think about the politics and when Aristotle's first starting and he's talking about the purpose of government, which is to get people to live the good life, right? That we should government should be set up to result in an increase in the virtue of its citizens. Now, I think back to, and one of the things that's got me now, and something that I may vote next week, it's very hard to detach me from politics, but one thing that made me think a lot when I was reading the book Starship Troopers, are you familiar with it?
Yeah, actually, I was going to bring that up a little bit earlier.
Okay.
You're talking about like voting qualifications. I was saying, what about national service? And then that made me think of Starship Troopers. Was that
this idea that being a citizen was not a matter of birthright or anything, that it was a choice, that somebody would decide when they're coming on their adult years that I want to be a citizen. I want to be a person not just who lives here and works here, but I want to participate in the government. And he mentioned how his father was a successful businessman, but not a citizen. And they lived, first of all, I guess, in a society where somebody didn't feel threatened by the idea of not voting, that he was able to run his business and all of that. But when somebody decided that I'm willing to do 2 years of federal service, that I'm willing to give 2 years of my life to the good of the whole, whatever I'm assigned to do, I will do it. And then those people come out of there and they are the citizens, which I guess he's... Heinlein is if I'm even pronouncing that correctly, is maybe somewhat inspired by Aristotle and this idea that we need to have a place in our politics for the virtuous and not just the, you know, the few and the many.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. We, you know, that book itself, we only get partial glimpses of what their educational system is like and what the reasoning behind it was like. And it's always in these interactions. I forget the name of the character, but he was the guy who taught the civics class.
Philosophy class. Yeah, there was this class that everybody had to take, and it was they had to audit it. No grade was given, and it was always taught by somebody who was a citizen and had done their federal service. And so everybody had to sit in that class, and the objective there was kind of to separate the people who want to be, you know, at the end of that class, they decide, I either want to pursue citizenship or I don't. And it's like that, there were no tests in the class. There were no nothing. You just basically sat there and listened to this guy talk.
You had to do some interaction. He'd put you on the spot, too, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I think, if I remember right, the curriculum was sort of a contact with you know, what people call the classics or the greats to bring up issues or ideas or moral dilemmas. So Aristotle would have figured in there, but there's so many others who, you know, have discussed the nature of regimes as well. I'd have to, you know, it'd be interesting to go back and see who's actually mentioned in that book. Because Heinlein himself was a libertarian. And he took a lot of heat for that from some people as well. And Starship Troopers is early on in his career. He often took a lot of heat for that as well, because people thought he was, you know, endorsing something like a fascist regime, because, you know, there's this notion of, and this is kind of interesting.
The notion of the military being seen as more virtuous than the average.
And the emphasis on looking at the totality of the society. I mean, one of the differences between, say, an Aristotelian vision of the common good and a fascist version is fascism subordinates the individual to the society or the state. It says that you and I have value insofar as we contribute to the society. And in that sense, you could also have it within a corporation, or, you know, we may have encountered that within educational institutions where you're just a cog in the machine grinding out, you know, student learning objectives and metrics to get more money coming in. So long as there's an emphasis on the importance of individuals as individuals, you know, you can have as much focus on the common good and an organic society without it going into fascism. And as a matter of fact, it may be better off moving towards something like that, if we can, you know. I don't know that we have the cultural resources anymore here in America to do that, except in local areas, you know, and smaller institutions.
Okay, so. I can definitely see where you're coming from there, as far as just because we're not really thinking about that. It really is about this faction triumphing over this faction and getting its agenda accomplished, and meanwhile ignoring some of the things like the national debt, the coming automations that, you know, we're not really preparing for those things that, and in a way, our politicians actually benefit from there being turmoil. They don't benefit from people working or from addressing the problems. And so I guess that's the big problem that I see maybe with voting. It's not necessarily that I have a problem deciding which party I favor more, but as far as just thinking, okay, really, what good am I doing by stepping into a polling place and, okay, I am voting to support a faction, and there, I've done my civic duty, which really, my civic duty should be more in what am I doing to actually make life better for other people. I'm considering possibly Tuesday, instead of election day, possibly having some kind of e-lecture day, where I spend time educating people. Like, I actually get online and take questions and talk about, like, civic engagement and really just as far as just civic virtue and the like, that perhaps I do more for society by, you know, doing the sort of thing that I do and you do, going out and educating people rather than saying, okay, well, I'm going to go stand in a line so that I can support this faction.
Yeah, that's actually a great idea. It's unfortunate that all my teaching is so concentrated on Tuesdays, so I can jump on with you.
Oh, gosh, yeah, that would be pretty amazing.
You're talking about sort of a deeper problem. You know, it's not just who to vote for. I think that's most people frame it in terms of, well, who should I vote for? And then it all falls into place after that. But going in and feeling like, well, does my vote actually matter? Is this doing the right thing? Those are sort of existential questions about the nature of voting itself, about the meaning involved in it, you know.
Meaning, and I tell you, that's really, I guess, what I'm looking for is that meaning. And beyond just here, I've got my sticker, I've done my civic duty, quote unquote, because I went and did this. I feel like it really, when it comes to just giving meaning and making the country better, that perhaps there are some other things that we can do. But it looks like I think I'm about to have to go to, yeah, it's getting about my time to go to work. And Greg, we'll have to do this. I think we did this about a year ago. We'll try to maybe do this a little more often. I always enjoy these chats.
Well, let's talk after the election. We'll see what the results were. And then you had that idea about using existentialist philosophy to help people embrace the disappointment and terror and all the other
okay emotions I like that. So we've got a pre-election thing going, and then perhaps sometime in the not so distant future we can talk about how do we get, because what you've said, and I think that's a thing that we can really latch on to, is the idea that in the United States, and other countries don't have this problem, I don't think, like we do, but the idea that the election's never over, that one election happens we're going right into another election. And so how is it that a citizen can transition from, okay, now it's time to support a party and vote, but then what is my civic duty once the election is over, and how can I really just make decisions that affect not only my own wellness, but the wellness of the community, and how can I contribute to the general virtue of the community? So again, ladies and gentlemen, I was joined by Dr. Greg Sadler, who has a YouTube channel. It's his name, Sadler, and also, I believe people can still find you at reason.io.
No, reasonio.com.
Yeah. Reasonio.com. Okay, so very interesting domain there. Okay, so reasonio.com. But yes, thanks again, Greg, and I look forward to talking to you at another time. Thank y'all for listening.
Thanks for having me on.